recorded was always in my head.
Checkerfin? Checkerfin?
Yes!
Rissy Education Gadfly
Sex Actions.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college high school
is
pain and suffering. In your face.
Listen to what that baby preaching, cause here's the Education Gadfly Show, yeah!
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here with my co-host, a man on everyone's short list for the next Treasury Secretary, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing, babe?
I'm good. How you doing, man?
A lot poorer than I was about a week ago.
Oh, wah, wah, wah. you know, you're one of those people living high on the hog, whereas these teachers out there making $30,000, $35,000 a year having to tighten their belt, you know?
Now, this was Obama's declaration, right? That a lot of these teachers are making $30,000 to $35,000?
This is correct. And yet, I've done a little work this morning to try to find out whether or not that is the case.
Well, here's a man from Chicago, so we know that's certainly not the case of the teachers he knows.
That is not the case in Chicago. I looked into the National Council on Teacher Quality's database on collective bargaining agreements where you can pull out salary information. It turns out even among starting teachers, almost all of the districts in that survey pay above $30,000 a year. And if you're looking at teachers with at least 5 years experience, which are, you know, you figure he doesn't mean for us to feel bad for teachers who are right out of college and, you know, making $31,000 and therefore have to drink, you know, bad beer instead of drinking good beer. No offense to our young staff around here, but come on, you know, you must be talking about people with a family, with a mortgage. So let's say at least 5 years experience. Those people are making on average in those big city districts, $47,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Obama's staff needs to coach him. Next time he talks about teachers, you know, struggling, that he should talk about teachers making $40,000, $45,000 a year, which, you know, is still, you know, that's a little more accurate, but they're still not living high in the hog like Frederick M. Hess is.
It doesn't really matter. He just wants us to, you know, feel badly for all the little people out there who got suckered into mortgages they can't afford, because God knows nobody has any culpability in this.
Well, that's right. But it's interesting, as he made that decision to talk about a teacher, you know, he could have said a cop or a fireman, mm-hmm, or, you know, many other things, but he went for teacher.
Mm-hmm.
He went for teacher, trying to solidify his teacher base.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, we're not going to talk about policy, but I'm going to mention a teacher. All right, we've got lots to cover today. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to hear from Amber with her research minute.
Mm-hmm.
Stafford's going to rate that reform. So much fun. I tell you, the excitement, whew, you can just feel it in the air. Along with that fall chill.
It's a whole new crew. Think back to last fall. We had different features, different cast of characters.
That's right.
But we're still here.
Okay, and we do have a new person helping us out with Pardon the Gadfly today. It is Fordham fellow Ben. Fellow Ben, take it away.
Last week, the White House released an admirable report on urban Catholic schools, preserving a national treasure, with many sound recommendations. Back in the 1970s, right before the Watergate earthquake hit, the Nixon administration released a similar report, which was widely ignored. Is there any reason to believe that this one won't be ignored too? Is there any hope for inner city Catholic schools?
Sure doesn't look like it, huh?
Okay, Rick. I mean, so here's the deal. That, you know, the White House has not had great timing on this issue. Okay. First,
it took them 7 years and 8 months to get around to issuing the report.
All right. So first of all, they waited till the end of the administration to focus on Catholic schools. Then they held a summit on Catholic schools last spring, a week after the Pope's visit. Now, the problem with that is that, you know, a week after the Pope's visit, all of the newspapers in the country have already written about Catholic issues for, for days and days, and they don't care to write anymore about a White House summit. Whereas a certain think tank in town released a report on Catholic schools the week before the summit and got huge press.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then they decide to release the report from that summit on a Friday during a financial crisis, 5 weeks until a presidential election.
I mean, it's crazy, right? I mean, how about a little urgency? If they'd gotten this thing out before Labor Day, it could have been part of the conversation during that dead period in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd actually released it, I don't know, on a Monday,
yep,
when people are looking, you know, when there's actually a real news hole.
Mm-hmm.
It's just weak, you know. But given this point that the 72 Catholic report gets swamped by Watergate, and that this one lands in the middle of this Wall Street meltdown, real question is who up there has it in to make sure the Catholic schools aren't getting the love and attention they want?
Now, see, this is interesting. Does God want Catholics to attend public school? Is that what this is about?
Wow.
Or maybe he likes charter schools. It's possible. I mean, charter schools didn't come out of nowhere. Okay, we're going to get some letters on that one. All right, Ben, next question.
In today's Education Gadfly, our own Rick Hess argues that Michelle Rhee's Plan B, a strategy to fire bad teachers, is even better than her Plan A, which was to offer mega salary bonuses to teachers willing to give up tenure protections. Is Hess right or just mean-spirited?
He's mean.
Yeah.
He's mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Ricky, I mean, come on here. This is a very interesting argument that you make here. You're basically saying, you know what? You're glad that these teachers are going to get fired and that these other teachers aren't going to get any raises. I mean, what, you know, you're like the Grinch that stole back to school. Defend yourself.
So there's a couple of things going on. First, you know, I don't mean, you know, what I don't mean to suggest is that Michelle's Plan A is a bad plan. Sure, it makes a lot of sense to pay good teachers a lot more money, and it makes sense to try to build a professional environment. Problem is that they were going about doing this the way we always go about new dollars and new programs in education, which is you bake in the old and you layer everything on top. And in fact, to try to make sure that the folks currently in DCPS weren't going to torpedo the plan, even folks who didn't go on to the new pay scale were going to get huge bonuses just for being there. This is a problem. What's happened now is the D.C. superintendent's office, headed by Deborah Gist and Michelle, have actually created an opportunity in which they can remove teachers when they come up for teacher renewal and by more aggressively using principal evaluation to try to identify ineffective teachers and get them out of there.
And what do you think? Is this going to actually work? I mean, this is one of these things that sounds great on paper, but it requires principals to take evaluation seriously. It requires the central office then to move swiftly to remove teachers. I mean, why isn't this going to end up taking years and years?
It requires legal support. It's going to be costly. It's going to provoke bad feelings. Absolutely. All of that stuff. And, you know, actually, this is kind of an advertisement for this Fordham AEI conference next week, because one of the issues that we'll talk about in this conference on courts and the law and education is the way in which superintendents sometimes paralyze themselves. The reality is this is going to be very much a test of the political will in the district. Mm-hmm. If Michelle doesn't blink, if Fenty doesn't blink, if the dollars are there and they got the legal supports and the HR supports, this can work. Mm-hmm. If those things aren't there, you're exactly right.
You know, Fordham fellow Ben was a teacher in DCPS until very recently.
Did you get pushed out, Ben? I'm sorry about that.
Ben, would you have voted on that if you got to vote on that contract, the Plan A? You think you would have supported it?
If I had known it was coming up, I would have stayed in the teaching business.
point for the reformers. This is the argument.
Yeah, that actually it is. That's right. But instead, Fordham, doing its job, tried to pluck one of the best teachers out of D.C.
He's at a place, right, where you have opportunities to grow and develop new skills. What a crazy concept.
I hope that's the case. All right. Like skills, like asking questions on a podcast. Okay. Topic number three.
Last week during the vice presidential debate, Sarah Palin voluntarily brought up education. What to make of her remarks.
Now, Rick, before you respond, I want to remind everybody that the Thomas Fordham Institute is a nonpartisan organization, that the IRS does not want us doing anything to endorse a candidate or anyway, sway the election. Okay, go ahead.
I just want to know who wrote her talk. Was she on point? If the official McCain position is that the only problem with American education is we got to do more shutouts to third graders in Wasilla, that we got to spend more, and that those darn teachers are gold darn underpaid and underappreciated. If this is the extent of the McCain camp's thinking on ed reform, that's frightening.
I mean, Rick, it's remarkable. We have Republican candidates here who are calling for higher pay for teachers, right? More funding for schools, who want to buy up all the bad mortgages in the country, who are blaming the financial mess on Wall Street greed. I mean, it's very confusing right now.
It's astonishing. You know, I mean, the reality is Palin, who ran to education on that question, she wasn't asked about education. Yep. She chose to address it. She was less reform minded than Obama had been speaking in Denver. Obama, who, you know, as wishy-washy as it strikes me he's been, had that kind of a dropped clause where he very quietly sneaked in the notion that more pay and we need more respect for teachers, but also more accountability, which didn't get a single clap, but he did mention it. Palin didn't even nod her head towards accountability or competition when she brought this up.
You know, we've heard from several listeners who have used phrases like the soft bigotry of low expectations.
In regards to Palin?
Well, in return to that debate performance, that's right. And somebody else that said something to the effect of, you know, this is what happens when really smart people, as in Sarah Palin, don't get access to a very good education.
Well, I just got to tell you, I was astonished. I was astonished that, like, Kathleen Parker afterwards decided that Palin had changed her mind and that she actually did. because I was sitting there watching that debate thinking, oh my God, this is just painful. I'm feeling for this woman. And so to have people say afterwards, oh, she was cocky and confident. I'm like, dude, did you listen to her?
All right. And that's all the time we have for Bart and the
freshmen give better answers routinely. And not just at UVA. When I taught at Suffolk, I got better answers out of freshmen sometimes.
What's wrong with Suffolk?
Nothing. I'm just saying it wasn't just one place.
This is like the Saturday Night Live skit with the Joe Biden debate. Did you watch that one?
Yeah, it was fabulous.
That one from Scranton. And Scranton is a cesspool. Is that what you're saying about Suffolk? I tell you. All right. Well, that's enough fun with that. It's now time for the serious portion of our program. That time when we dig into education research, which is a serious, serious business.
For 60 seconds.
Okay, Amber Winkler, 60 seconds. Tell us what's happening in education research this week.
You search, research, research. It's the Gadfly Research Minute.
Okay, Amber, go.
All right. A report out this week by Brookings Institution, the Urban Institute, and 21st Century School Fund. There's a big concern over the plummeting enrollment declines in D.C. They've come out with a very data-rich report about all things D.C. This is just a great report if you're interested in anything about D.C. It's not particularly heavy on policy recommendations and whatnot. It gives great data about the differences between public and charter schools, the housing market, the demographics of the various neighborhoods, even gives some history of white flight, school enrollment data, where there's access to high quality school options and where there's not, gives some great statistics about just the differences in the segregation of the neighborhoods, i.e. there's 90% in Ward 7 and 8 are black. And 80% of Ward 8, we have white constituents. Lots of differences as in the per funding cost as far as student-teacher ratios, highly qualified teachers, et cetera. So bottom line is, if you're interested in anything about D.C. public schools or charter schools, read this report.
This sounds like catnip to PhDs, baby.
Mm-hmm. Who are studying the District of Columbia.
That's right.
Demographic trends in the district.
Okay,
you can tell. You can tell Amber's a PhD. You hear it in her voice. She's like, they have tables of migration patterns.
It is an exciting report. I'm just telling you, if you need to know anything about DC, pick up this report.
Mike, you had a coffee table that was wobbling a little, right? This sounds like it's going to do the job for you.
Yeah. See now Amber, I thought part of the exciting part about this report that you may not have had time to tell us about. So the question is. Doesn't it? There's also this information that shows that if DC schools got better.
Yes.
And
that was the part that I had to cross out, Mike, because of the 60 seconds.
This was all guesswork and extrapolation. This was the ridiculous part of the report.
Yes. One of their key recommendations was that they need to improve academic achievement.
Okay. And then that's going to attract more families to the district, and they'll actually start sending their kids to public
schools. Yeah, but this is pure guesswork. I mean, the numbers on which they actually base these projections for 2015 enrollment.
Yeah.
You know, they're taking some correlations that exist, and then they're, you know, and then they're extrapolating like crazy.
All right, Amber. So what's the song this week that goes
along? The song is Rich Girl by Daryl Hall and John Oates, because apparently, you know, the richy folks get a lot more better treatment in D.C.
You're a rich girl, and you're going too far, because you know it don't matter anyway. You can rely on the old man's money. You can rely on the old man's money.
Okay. And that's this week's Research Minute. You know, Rick, I didn't expect Amber to go for that class warfare there at the end. But that just seems to be a theme in our political discourse lately.
It's the McCain-Palin conservatism.
That's right. Okay, Stafford, that's right. Well, it is that time we wait for all week long. It's Rate That Reform time. Still in need of some sort of snappy tune. Stafford, tell us, what reform are we rating this week?
Well, Mike, show and tell is a classic pastime for younger students. You know, you find a shell on the beach during summer vacation or a treasured family heirloom to represent your heritage. But recently, this wholesome activity took a turn towards the macabre in Stevensville, Montana. Perhaps deciding that anatomy was the lesson of the day, one parent brought to school for show and tell a dead bat. She not only brought the dead bat into the building full of little kids who are, you know, breeding grounds for germs to begin with, but into both of her children's classrooms. One is in kindergarten and one is in fifth grade. And then had the students touch it. Dealing with dead animals 101, don't touch. Nice job, Mom. The school is administering rabies shots, of course, to the affected children, which will be paid for by the school's insurance. So in terms of prom definition, I'm going to give the school a C. It goes without saying that you don't let young children play with dead animals. And rabies shots are no-brainer, but I'm still wondering how this ever happened. The school can't be held responsible for this mother's shocking lack of judgment, but it is responsible for what happens inside its own walls. And this is no cute Dolly my grandma gave me show and tell. You better believe the students were gathered around this mother shrieking while this morbid display was taking place. Is there a problem of chronic teacher deafness in this school? As for the financial aspect of this, the school's insurance should pay for the shots, and at a whopping $800 a shot, let's just hope this school is full of the small class size movement. But honestly, rabies vaccines are a month-long ordeal, and I pity the little six-year-old who will have a month-long battery of run-ins with the needle as a result of this string of poor decisions. As for the execution, I'm going to give this school another C. Yes, the shots will prevent the rabies, or so studies show, but this whole situation should have been prevented from the get-go. That dead bat should never have made it into even one classroom, let alone two. I mean, that's two separate teachers, a kindergarten teacher and a fifth grade teacher. And somebody, please, teach that mother about germs.
Oof, I wanted to hear Mr. T deliver that. I pity the fool who's got I pity the fool who's going to get a month of rabies shots.
So the rabies shots, I guess I always thought you had to get bitten by something in order to need to get rabies
shots. Well, apparently they're worried that the kids have touched the teeth of the bat.
Huh.
And in so doing, they maybe prick their fingers on it.
Hmm. Is there any chance that if they had done that, that the children themselves would have turned into bats? Is that what they were really concerned about?
Wear bats. They turn into bats at night.
Yeah, that's right. There you go.
So as far as we know, the children are doing okay now. Allegedly,
none of them have gotten a rabies. Okay. But I mean, honestly, you bring a bat to school. They're yep. six, right? The kindergartners, at mm-hmm. least, not the fifth graders. You're going to have the little kids running around shrieking. I mean, the parent is holding the bat, right?
Yeah.
Where are the adults? Who did not notice that there was a woman standing there with a dead bat having little kids touch it?
But yet again, Stafford, I feel like, you know, I know you haven't been in the classroom yourself as a teacher. Rick has. So,
but
Rick,
it was
what
the
do you
show
think?
It was the show and tell portion. The teacher's supposed to be there. It was during class
the
time.
The teacher is there, but perhaps the teacher feels like it's hard to have a conflict with a parent.
Or maybe it's a micromanagement question because, right, you're also always being encouraged to have students not just learn things abstractly, but actually connect them. And the teacher's thinking, hey, dead bat, kid's chance to really see and touch a bat, better than just having them read about bats.
Oh, this is hands-on learning.
Hands-on.
Mm. I see.
So it's really progressivism, baby.
This is why I think all children should just learn via the internet. Much safer.
Kind of the antithesis of progressivism.
Exactly. All right, Stafford, thank you for rating that reform. Rick, as always, it's a pleasure.
Oh, indeed, Mike.
Okay, well, until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Signing off.